Greetings to all of God's people. This is again Mordecai Joseph. We're today in lesson 203. And last time, we're at the point where the children of Egyptians, were desperate. And so they came to Joseph and asked him to give them food. And he told them to give them all the money. And so when that was over, in other words, a point reached where Egypt didn't have any money, and all the money ended up in the coffers of Pharaoh, which is a unique situation in human history. And after that, they came back to him, and verse 19 we read, when the money was gone, they basically came to him. Well, let's read in verse 18, and when that year was ended, they came unto him the second year, and said unto him, "We will not hide from my Lord how that our money is all spent, and the herds of the cattle are my Lord's." So I ended up with all their property, with the exception of the lands, and there is nothing left in the sight of my Lord but our bodies and our lands. Wherefore, verse 19, should we die before your eyes, both we and our land? In other words, you know, if we don't grow things, no crops, everything's going to be dead. Buy us and our land for bread, and we and our land will be bondmen unto Pharaoh. So first they lost their money and cattle, and now they're losing their land and their own bodies. In other words, it's going to be a total slavery there, which is very interesting because in the aftermath of this total slavery of Egypt, then Israel went into slavery. And obviously their slavery was much worse. At least now they have a benevolent ruler. It was not a dictator, but a ruler. And they were cared for, and that was a short period of time. But the reality is that once this period was over, now there was a new reality in Egypt. And all the old, as the commentary tells us, the old feudal nobility of Egypt disappeared in the Hyksos period, and from the time of the 18th dynasty onward, we find the land which had formerly been held by local proprietors belonging either to Pharaoh or to the temples. And at the same time, public granaries make their appearance, that is, during the time of the Hyksos, which means Joseph, and the superintendent of, of which became one of the most important of Egyptian officials. In other words, when that continued after Joseph, then the man who occupied that office, that continued because still Egypt had no cattle and they had no money, you know, when the good years, when the bad years, that is, were over, and they had no land and they were all slaves. So that reality continued, and ironically, even while the children of Israel were in bondage, in slavery, so were the Egyptians, only the Egyptians didn't have to do the hard bondage, as the Israelites did. So it was a situation where Pharaoh basically was an absolute owner of the land. And then when God obviously punished Egypt, then Pharaoh lost all the cattle that he had and all the cattle that Egypt had, and the land was devastated, you see, and his money. Well, you can eat money when you have no food. And so, this is what they're requesting of him now. Please buy us, buy our land, and this way we will be bondmen unto Pharaoh, and give us seed, that we may live and not die. In other words, food to eat. They couldn't sow anything, obviously. That's what the days of famine. And that the land be not desolate. So Joseph bought all the land of Egypt for Pharaoh, for the Egyptians sold every man his field, because the famine was sore upon them. And the land became Pharaoh's. But it's interesting that we don't have any mention here of the land of Canaan. Egypt was sold to Pharaoh, but Canaan was not. So somehow they managed. And as for the people, he removed them city by city, from the one end of the border of Egypt, even to the other end thereof. In other words, as he removed them from the cities, he used the cities for depots for the grain. And so, even the cities, since they couldn't own anything anymore anyway, He could do with them whatever was necessary. And so they were removed from the cities, and obviously they were placed in the farms now. But here we read, only the land of the priests bought he not, for the priests had a portion from Pharaoh, and did eat their portion which Pharaoh gave them. In other words, they, under the law, the Egyptian law, were not in that category of the ordinary citizens, and so they didn't have to sell their lands, since they had food. The Egyptians had to sell their land and had to give up all their money and cattle because they had no food. But the Egyptians, by law, had it. And so a new reality developed as time went by, where either Pharaoh or the temples or the priest owned the land and the granaries. And so riches were concentrated now in the hands of the very, very few at the top, and all the rest were in slavery. And you can see there also that God is already beginning to punish Egypt long before his own people went into bondage. Because now all of Egypt is not in the condition that they were before Joseph appeared on the scene, before the famine that came by God on the land of Egypt. So it had, you know, double purpose there. On one hand, to make his nation a great nation, but his nation was a great nation in the midst of a nation that was in slavery. And God created conditions, and obviously, you know, there is much more to the story than we can tell now. But the reality is that when God does anything with his people, he creates also conditions around them for the purpose of doing his will with his people. And so now, all of Egypt is in slavery. All of Egypt is moneyless, penniless, you know, landless, homeless, in one sense. You know, they don't have even the cities where they had before that. And in the midst of that, his people are rising to the top, because where did his people live now? They lived in Goshen, the best land. And they had the delta, the Nile there, right there, so there was water, and they could still continue to grow their whatever they needed to. At least a few things. And they were in charge of the cattle of Egypt, or the Pharaoh. And now they had ended up with all the cattle of all of Egypt in the land of Goshen. A lot of mumus in one place. But that meant an awful lot of riches for Israel. So you can see what God was doing here. In essence, impoverishing all of Egypt and enriching his own people. So you can imagine later on why the Egyptians turned against Israel when the Hyksos were gone and now the natives took over. In other words, there was rebellion against the Hyksos, you know, for this kind of laws. And it was a tax rebellion in that sense, and it was a land rebellion. You know, many things were involved here. And that's how a new king arose that didn't know Joseph. But in the meantime, Israel was extremely rich. And they had abundance. And so when you see that the new king takes over, he does not, under the circumstances, you know, go to war against Israel. But he just says, well, let's gradually enslave them. But at no point do you ever see the Pharaoh taking away the land of Egypt, that is of Goshen, or even the cattle of Israel away from them, which is very interesting. So it was not the classical slavery that you have, where a slave owns nothing, like, you know, just like the Egyptians, they owned nothing at this point. But Israel continued to live in their own homes. They were not removed. You know, they had the labor force, yes, but their homes were still their homes. Their cattle were still their cattle, you see. And they still had their gold and their silver with them. As a matter of fact, even at the end time, you read the same description, that when God brings back his children, the people of Israel, from all the lands of the earth, he says, they shall come back with their silver and their gold. So even at that point, even though they're going to be in a form of slavery, it's not going to be the classical in a form of slavery where they have absolutely nothing. And this is what Egypt is going through now. And so the land of the priest was not sold. He didn't buy it. For the priests had a portion from Pharaoh, so they didn't need to sell it. And verse 23, then Joseph said unto the people, behold, I have bought you this day and your land for Pharaoh. And lo, he received for you, and he shall sow the land. So now he gives them seed so they can continue to sow the land. But obviously it's not going to be as bountiful as before that, because there isn't rain, there's a drought. But what they had was the Nile. And so now they had to all, create ditches and go to the Nile and bring water from there and water the whole area. And later on, when God brings Israel into his land, he tells them that they're not going to have to do that anymore in the land of Canaan, because there is going to be the rain, the first rain, the latter rain, the dew in between. And they're not going to have to water the ground with their foot. What it means is, that they had to take buckets, go to the river, and get water and come back and water their fields. It's not going to be footwork, and they're not going to have to dig canals and do all that hard work. And to this very day, Egypt is in a very poor condition because of that. Not much rain in that land, and not much water either. And so this is what God is saying here. That is, Joseph says to them, behold, I bought you this day and your land for Pharaoh. Lo, he received for you, and you shall sow the land. And it shall come to pass at the ingatherings that you shall give a fifth unto Pharaoh, 20%. And four parts shall be for your own. That's not bad. You still end up with 80%. Look at us today, the taxation that we have over us, the slavery of the present-day pharaohs of the land. And, we pay up to 40-50% of our taxes. We work for the government, almost half a year, or at least 4 years for many people. And so we are today in a much worse condition, in one sense, than these people, the children of Egypt. And he required only that is 20%. And that was very benevolent on his part, because this way they were not totally impoverished. They had plenty to eat, and they were not hungry. So, you see the mercy of God there. And that became the manner of, the king of Egypt later on. Became a law, 20% tax. Where before that they did not have, this kind of a tax. And then it continued as years went by, and many other lands began to do the same thing also. Impose tax on the nations, and of course the government ended up with it all, the king, the authorities, whatever it may be. And this system continues to our very day. And in the days of the Maccabean, they had to pay the Syrians 30% of their crops, and they were left with 70%. And so, sometimes things were more difficult. Anyway, this is what they end up with. In verse 24, we read, and they said, you have saved our lives. Let us find favor in the sight of my Lord, and we will be Pharaoh's bondmen. And they were happy about the situation. Imagine that. Now they're getting to this point, and that's what happens to us many times. When we have so much, we don't appreciate what we have. When things are taken away from us, then we begin to appreciate every little thing that we have. And you see a situation like that here. And that's in essence what God is going to do to all of humanity. He's going to take away from them everything. And even their money and gold, it says they're going to throw it into the street because, they wouldn't find any use for it. And then whatever God gives them later on, they're going to be extremely glad, because they're going to develop appreciation for whatever God gives them. And nowadays, we have lost that by large, in most countries, especially the developed countries that have plenty, we take it all for granted. And so here they are very happy. They are happy to even be slaves to Pharaoh, because at least they are alive, and they have food to eat. And Joseph made it a statute concerning the land of Egypt unto this day. So to the day of Moses, a long time after that, that law is still in force, and it continued to be that way. And of course, other nations copied the same thing. Only the land of the priests alone became not Pharaoh's, and Israel dwelt in the land of Egypt, in the land of Goshen, the cream of the crop of the land, and they got them possessions therein. While the Egyptians are being impoverished, Israel gets possessions. And this is what God was giving them. And they were fruitful, and they multiplied exceedingly. You see? Well, he was in essence impoverishing all of Egypt, and they were bondmen, and they had no money and no cattle. On the other hand, Israel, in the land of Egypt, become very rich. Well, that's God's work. And you can imagine later on, you know, as time went by, you know, the Egyptians were becoming very, very jealous of that. And they thought, well, that, all that stuff, is, you know, belongs to us. You've stolen it from us. You know, that's the way people, as time goes by, begin to think. And so it was okay for them what Pharaoh did later on to the children of Israel, and they became partakers of that themselves. And of course, God had to punish Egypt in a much more severe way later on. And so this is what we read here. And then we continue with chapter 47. And Jacob lived, in verse 28 now. And Jacob lived in the land of Egypt 17 years. And so when he came, he was 130. Now he's 147. And it's interesting, when Jacob left his father, and his father was around 130 at the time, and now he's 147, and when he came to Egypt, he was 130 also. And so the days of Jacob and the years of his life were 147 years. And the time drew near that Israel must die. And he called his son Joseph and said unto him, If now I have found favor in your sight, put, I pray you, your hand under my thigh. And as we mentioned that earlier, when we came to that, the first thing was mentioned with Abraham when he sent his servant Eliezer to fetch a wife for Isaac, that is Rebekah. That's what he told him. It was a custom of the time. The man was sitting on a chair. The master would sit on the chair, and the servant would kneel down, and he would, you know, hold him by the knees and the thighs, you know, right under it. And, you know, people come up with different customs. This is one of them. It may look a little bit strange to us today. Then, you know, they may look at us and think that some of our customs are strange too. So, you know, we cannot really evaluate, you know, another society or culture from our point of view, because generally, you know, we don't get it right. That's why people look at others and think they're strange, and the others look at them and think they're strange. And obviously, that's another way to look at things that are not the way we do things. They're different, but they're not strange. They're not weird. That's human nature. Anyway, this is what he was saying to him. You do that, and deal kindly and truly with me. Bury me not, I pray you, in Egypt. But when I sleep with my fathers, you know, and the terminology in the Bible from the days of old was, when you die, you sleep. Just like when you go to sleep every night. So every night when we go to sleep, we die, and then we get up in the morning and we're resurrected. We experience that, you know, in between we know nothing. And so it is with the dead. That's why God uses this terminology of sleep, and you see Paul later on using that very thing, you know, we shall not all sleep. Because that's in essence what it is. But when I sleep with my fathers, you shall carry me out of Egypt and bury me in their burying place. And he said, I will do so as you have said. And it's very interesting, there are only two people, all the children of Israel here, the family of Jacob, that were buried in the land of Canaan, and that's Jacob, and then later on, Joseph. And ironic thing about it, Joseph was dead. He was carried through the wilderness for 40 years, you see. And he's the only one of all the children of Israel that were over 20 that made it into the land, being dead. And yet made it into the land of Canaan. Not even Moses made it, or Aaron, and only Joshua and Caleb. What an irony. And this is what he's requesting of him here. And so Joseph said, I will do as you have said. And he said, swear unto me. Which is interesting, you know, why tell him swear? You know, I mean, his word should be good enough. But I guess Jacob just wanted to make sure that nothing will be forgotten as time goes by. He wanted to, I guess that was also a part of the custom, that when you hold on the thigh of a man, not only you say you're going to do, but you also swear. So it's a part of the same ceremony, so to speak. And so it was not totally, you know, out of context, you know, this thing of swearing. And so he swore unto him, and Israel bowed down upon the bed's head. And you look into other examples, you see the same thing too, like with Abraham and the Philistines, and Isaac and the Philistines. They make a covenant, and then they swear. So there was a part of it, so it's not a question of mistrust. It just, that's the way they did it. Even God, as it says about God. That he could not swear by any greater than himself, and so he swore by his own glory, his own name, that he will fulfill the promises that he made. So, you know, you would say, you know, why does he have to swear? You know, all he has to say, just say, I'll do it or I wouldn't do it. But, you know, that was a part of the ceremony. Now, obviously, human beings oftentimes abuse that to the point that when in the days of Jesus Christ, he told them, don't even swear. He said, that was customary, you know, that you make a promise and then you swear. He said, don't even do that because people were abusing that. And he said, just let your yea be yea and your nay be nay. That is, until you become righteous enough where swearing, you know, then would mean something. And so this is what you hear here. And, you know, you see many examples of that. To Melchizedek, we read that God swore, you know, that he's going to be a priest forever and ever. You know, why does the father need to swear to the son? Well, when you understand, you know, the terminology and the meaning and the importance and the absolute, you see, the absolute fact that you're going to do it, and that was a problem. When people swore and didn't do it absolutely, they were doing it in vain. And so they were taking the name of God in vain, they were taking, you know, their own name in vain, and you know, their own word and their own character, and everything became meaningless. And so if we're to swear, it's not that Christ said, you know, don't swear anymore, you're not allowed to swear. You know, some people misunderstood what he's saying. He's the one that later on told Israel, the day will come when you're not going to swear anymore by Baals, you see. And he's the one that gave them the law that when you swear in the name of the Lord your God. And in the future, he said, they're going to swear by his name again. The point is, you know, if you are men of character, men of righteousness, and then you understand what swearing is all about, you see, and you bind yourself, just like you make a vow, you see, then you can swear. But if you are the kind of a person that you have no character and you are not going to keep your word, then that's what he's saying. Don't swear. And some of us have taken it to extreme, and we thought, well, we go to court, they ask us to swear, we don't swear because Christ said, don't swear. Well, don't swear if you are going to lie. You know, if you're not a man of your word, if you're not a man of character. You see, that's one thing. Anyway, in chapter, at the end of the chapter here, in verse 31, he said, swear unto me, and he swore unto him, and Israel bowed down upon the bed, and in other words, he just died. He didn't die at this time, sorry. And he swore unto him, and Israel bowed down upon the bed's head. In other words, was a part of the ceremony. Also, he's acknowledging the covenant here, the swearing, the promise. And that's what it means to bow down. In other words, an acknowledgement. It's a part of the ceremony. In every case where there was a covenant made, where there was an important thing, that's basically what they went through. They will talk to each other, they would make a covenant, they would make a promise, and they would swear, and each one of them would bow to each other, and in that they would acknowledge the whole thing as being true and sure. And that became a matter of honor, and in the Middle East, honor was extremely important, even more than life. People would rather lose their life than lose their honor, because then you'll be a living dead and shamed for the rest of your life and your whole family. And so obviously, people took these matters seriously. And so in chapter 48, we continue, and it came to pass after these things that one said to Joseph, behold, your father is sick, probably one of his brothers, and he took with him his two sons, Manasseh and Ephraim, because he knew that the time is getting close, that's the time for blessing. And so one told Jacob and said, behold your son, Joseph comes unto you, and Israel strengthened himself and sat upon the bed, you know, his own bed. And Jacob said unto Joseph, God Almighty appeared unto me at Luz, you know, in English they say Laz, but Luz, that's the name of it, and in the land of Canaan, and bless me. That name became after that Bethel. He's, you know, he gave it that name, Bethel. Bethel, that is the house of God, but, you know, the Canaanite name was Luz. And he blessed me and said unto me, Behold, I will make you fruitful and multiply you, and I will make of you a company of peoples, many nations that is, and will give this land to your seed after you for an everlasting possession. You know, if Arabs could read English, and when I say read English, I mean there are a lot of Arabs in this country, they read English, they speak English, but, you know, the proverbial, do you read English? In other words, do you understand what you're reading? And, you know, if they were to read this one, you know, they would have settled the whole problem that they have now in the Middle East, but they don't, unfortunately. One of these days they're going to read it, and they would understand it, and then they would tell God, I read you plainly, you know what you said, and your will be done, and there is going to be peace. And so he said, God said, He's going to give it to me and to my sons for an everlasting possession. And now your two sons, who were born unto you in the land of Egypt, were before, that is, before I came unto you into Egypt, are mine. What is he doing here? He's adopting them. And how are they going to be his? He says, Ephraim and Manasseh, they're going to be mine, even as Reuben and Simeon. Not instead of Reuben and Simeon, as some in their misinformation. You know, they read the scriptures and they don't understand what they're reading because they've got a bias already and a pet theory about what it means, and so they have to twist the scriptures to fit their own concept. He didn't say, I want them to be mine instead of Reuben and Simeon. He said, as Reuben and Simeon are mine, and Reuben is the firstborn and Simeon is the second, so will Ephraim and Manasseh. You see? Ephraim will become like the firstborn, even though he's the secondborn, and Manasseh will be like Simeon, the secondborn. That's an adoption ceremony, so he could pass on, you know, their blessing directly to them. It is not a replacement. But people, unfortunately, you know, especially the ones that discovered one day that they are Israel, and, you know, people go from one extreme to the other. Now that they discover they are Israel, now they're telling everybody and themselves, now we are Israel and all the others are not. You see? And, you know, that's a chauvinistic arrogance when you think about it. Ignorance, that's a problem where people don't have much knowledge. You know, they have the zeal of God, but not according to knowledge. And so they begin to talk like that. And they think Israel means only Ephraim and Manasseh. What about Reuben, Simeon, and Levi, and Naphtali, and Dan, and Asher? You see? Now, what about Judah? Well, we covered that subject before that, showing from the point of view of God that God is true and man is a liar. In other words, every person that says that, contrary to the scripture, that Judah is not Israel, is a liar. Because God made it very plain. There are two houses of Israel. One is Judah and one is Israel. One the northern kingdom, one the southern kingdom. They're all Israelites anyway. They're all the children of Israel. They're all going to come back and become one stick and they're all going to be Israel. So obviously, this is not what Jacob was doing here. And Ephraim and Manasseh, he said, they're going to be mine, just like Reuben and Simeon, they shall be mine. And your issue, in other words, anybody that comes from you, any other children that you're going to have, that you're going to beget after them, which he may or may not, we don't know. We don't have any records of that. But on the other hand, God was not interested in recording everything. He said, they shall be mine. In other words, they shall be yours. Anybody that comes after them will be yours. So anybody after them is not going to be adopted by me. You see, they're not interested in many more tribes, just that was the number that God inspired him. And that's why he's saying that. And they shall be called after the name of their brethren in their inheritance. So they can join Ephraim and Manasseh and be among their tribes and receive, you know, a portion with them, not apart from them. But they're going to be yours while this will become directly my sons. And so Ephraim and Manasseh became the sons of Israel, not the sons of Jacob, in terms of the adoption and the legality of the matter. Of course, Joseph is their father, and so they are called also Joseph. And as for me, when I came from Padan, Rachel died unto me in the land of Canaan in the way, when there was still some way to come unto Ephrat, and that's near Bethlehem, and I buried her there in the way to Ephrat, the same is Bethlehem. And to this very day, you find the wrong kind of people living there. And ironically, the children of Joseph are supporting them. You see, in other words, they support the rights of the Palestinians to own that very land where Rachel, their mother, was buried. And that's how far away they have departed from their God and their heritage. And so he said, this is where I buried her in Bethlehem. And Israel beheld Joseph's son and said, who are these? It's not that he doesn't know. But just a question that does not really have the real true meaning of I don't know who they are. But he was, remember, he sees them, but he has dim vision at this time like his father. And Joseph said unto his father, they are my sons whom God has given me here. And he said, bring them, I pray you, unto me, and I will bless them. And it's possible also that he hasn't seen them for quite a while, and he was, his eyes were getting dim for quite a while, so they may have grown, and may not have seen them in recent times, so he's not recognizing them. That's a possibility too. And so he says, you bring them here, I pray you that I will bless them. Well, what the blessing means that I will pass on to them, just like my fathers passed on those blessings to me. And now the eyes of Israel were dim for age, so that he could not see. And so, in other words, he could not see very, very clearly. Obviously, he still had a measure of vision. And he brought them near unto him, and he kissed them and embraced them. And Israel said unto Joseph, I had not, now mind you, at this time, in the Sunday school books, they show them as two little kids, and they were not. Because they were born before Jacob came down to Egypt, and Jacob has been around for 17 years. So, they're not little boys, And they are near 20, grown-up men. And so he embraces them and kisses them, and Israel said unto them, I had not thought to see your face, and Lord God has let me see your seed also. And Joseph brought them out from between his knees. What does that mean, between his knees? He was sitting there on a chair, obviously, and they were right next to him. And it's also a cliche, so to speak, an idiom, you might say, in Hebrew, of an affectionate relationship. When they are close to him, he was holding on to them, and so it's not that they were, between his knees, you're talking about boys in their 20s. An idiom. They were close to him, he was holding them, hugging them, whatever it may be, and now he's taking them over to his father, Jacob. So up to now, they were his, and the biblical terminology is, since children come from between the knees of a man, and so up to now, they were his, and so they were between his knees, but now he's giving them to Jacob, and so they will become his children, his adopted children. So, when you read this kind of terminology, you have to study also the meaning of it in Hebrew and the idioms of what these kind of things mean. And therefore, we see now in Joseph, he brings them he brings them to his father, and he fell down on his face to the earth. So he bows down to Jacob. He acknowledges, his father. And he acknowledges the right of his father also to do what he's going to do now, that is to take his sons and adopt them, and also to give the blessing to him. So he's honoring his father, and here it is, the governor of Egypt, and he bows down on his face to the earth. And that was also a custom that was done when the father would pass on the blessing to the son. That's exactly what the son would do. And Joseph took them both, Ephraim in his right hand and towards Israel's left hand, and Manasseh in his left hand toward Israel's right hand, because obviously he's thinking this is the firstborn, he should be on the right hand, and brought them near unto him. And Israel stretched out his right hand and laid it upon Ephraim's head, who was the younger, and his left hand upon Manasseh's head, guiding his hands wittingly. And you can see, even though you cannot see, doesn't have a good vision, and maybe he sees a little bit, sort of blurry, and he realizes that Joseph, you have to understand that, the Holy Spirit, God is inspiring all these things, and God wants exactly the blessings to go to the person that he wants. And so all that is by divine inspiration. all these things that are done. Of course, Joseph doesn't realize that yet. And so when so he does that, and he blessed Joseph. First, he blessed Joseph, the father, and said, "The God before whom my fathers Abraham and Isaac did walk, the God who has been my shepherd," you see? In other words, he says, "The Elohim before whom I walk, the Elohim who was my shepherd," but he doesn't stop here. He said, "The Elohim who has been my shepherd all my life long unto this day." In verse 16, now he gives this God another name. "The angel who has redeemed me from all evil, bless the lads." So again, like in many other places, God is revealing truth, and people, you know, who are blind don't see it. He tells them, look, the Elohim, you see, an English God, or, you know, goat, as it was, you know, in German. You know, this God is also an angel. Well, if you are an angel, whose angel are you? You know, an angel is a messenger, you see. So God recorded a long, long time ago the reality that there are two divine beings. And Israel had known it until the days of Christ. You see, and then since they rejected Jesus Christ, you know, they lost even that. And even at that time, not everybody was fully aware of that as they should have been, because the scriptures are very plain. They read them every Sabbath day. But it says blindness descended on Israel and then on Judah. It became very, very dark. And they could not see simple things. And to this very day, they read these things and they don't know what they're reading. You know, they scratch their head. You know, what does that mean? And so even this commentator here finally admitted in one place, I don't think it is here, in another place, but he said, I guess sometimes even God is called an angel. Well, that's a reality. The Father is not called an angel. He's nobody's messenger, but Jesus Christ, the second being, the one that became Christ, the Savior, the God of Israel, the one who is the direct God of Jacob and Abraham and Isaac and David and all that. He became the angel of the Lord. He was always the angel of the Lord since he was second in command. He always said, my Father is greater than I. So to think, you know, as some people say, you know, well, you know, monotheism, that's Jewish in origin, and then, you know, the Christians, they believed in monotheism on one hand, but then they added another one, and so they have two. And the Muslim believe only in the monotheism of only one. Well, all that is based on misinformation on people that have lost their light and understanding, because all the people of Israel, all of them, had known, you see, that there are two divine beings. And then they lost it. And now, you know, the time will come when they will regain that knowledge again. And then when they read the scriptures, you know, their eyes will be opened. You know, just like in my case. And you know, I was raised in a home that is an Orthodox Jewish home. And, you know, I was raised with this fact, you know, well, there is only one God, you know. Here, Israel, the Lord is God, the Lord is, you know, there is only one. And all the other scriptures. And then when my eyes were opened, just like God is going to open the eyes of the rest of my kinsmen, and all others on the face of the earth, you know, and the children of Ishmael and all those in Islam, well, then we begin to see, and it's so plain. You see, but that can come only from God. And if some of us have lost it, it's because, just like it happened to the people of Judah, you know, the lights went out. And many of us, unfortunately, more and more of us, they came to the point where they are mocking and have contempt for this knowledge and understanding, and then they make fun of it. They say, oh, you believe in this two-God theory. Well, they're just exposing their nakedness, and that's all there is to it. One of these days, they're going to be, you know, standing naked before Christ, and they're not going to have garments of righteousness. And so he makes it very plain. This God is also the angel who has redeemed me from all evil, bless the lad. You know, the angel is going to bless. Well, angels don't bless unless they're God. And let my name be named upon them. Why? Because I'm adopting them. That's the reason why. It's not because, you know, now from now on they're going to have only my name, and they're the only ones who are going to be called Israel. You know, just people in their ignorance, you know, that don't understand the scriptures. They think they do. Like little children, you know, they come across this kind of, you know, thing, and you know, they begin to invent their own ideas. He's not saying that. Since they're my kids, well, obviously they're going to have my name too. Just like Reuben and Simeon. He didn't dispossess the others. And so he said, let my name be named in them, and the name of my fathers, Abraham and Isaac. Not only my name, but also Abraham and Isaac. You see? Since they are my sons, well, Abraham will become, you know, also the direct grandfather. You see? And Isaac will become, that is, great-grandfather Abraham, and Isaac will become their grandfather, since they are my sons. and let them grow into a multitude in the midst of the earth. And when Joseph saw that his father was saying, that he was laying his right hand upon the head of Ephraim, it displeased him. One may ask, what was he doing all this time? He was doing that, but apparently he thought, maybe he doesn't realize what he's doing. And at this point, he was still talking about Joseph, and then he switched to his sons. And, Joseph was getting alarmed at what's happening here. And so, after the blessing is already given, now he wants to do something about it. So when Joseph saw that his father was laying his right hand upon the head of Ephraim, it displeased him, and he held up. He was going to do it on his own. You see, with God, you don't do that. When God does something, many times you think, God doesn't know what he's doing. You see? And many events that we see all around us, we think, God didn't know what he's doing. We don't think that way always. But in essence, our actions show that this is what we think. And so we think, we're going to correct things. We're going to alter things. You see? And some people think, government is not good. We're going to take things into our own hands. We're going to change it. It doesn't dawn on them that God is the one that appointed those leaders, as he made very plain to Nebuchadnezzar, to the intent, I brought you to this condition that the living may know that God rules in the kingdom of heaven, in the kingdom on this earth, in the whole universe. You see, he's in absolute charge everywhere. And he is the one that appoints those leaders, and oftentimes it takes base leaders, and people are to obey them. Not take things into their own hands, they're oppressive, pray to God and let God, deal with them. And some even in our midst, they're joining all those groups out there that think they're going to rebel against government. You can, within the law, you can do whatever you want to do. Whatever the government allows you. But when people take things into their own hand, they obviously take their eyes off God. And they start doing their own things. Joseph, not realizing here, he should have realized, that Jacob is not just blind. You see, his eyes may be blind, but his eyesight, the spiritual eyesight is not. He knows what he's doing. And so he had to correct him. And so this is what Joseph is doing now, not understanding. When Joseph saw that his father was laying his right hand upon the head of Ephraim, it displeased him, and he held up his father's hand. He did not even say anything to him, he just held it. He was going to do it on his own. Not your will be done, my dad, but my will. So he held up his father's hand to remove it from Ephraim's head unto Manasseh's head. And Joseph said unto his father, "No, not so, my father. For this is the firstborn. Put your right hand upon his head." And you don't do that to your father, give him orders. And obviously it's a matter of misunderstanding on the part of Joseph, and also he did not realize that this kind of matters are by the hand of God and not by the hand of man. Even Isaac, when he in essence was trying to do his own thing and give the blessing to Esau instead of to Jacob, he had to realize at the end, that was the will of God to give it to Jacob. And so when he told Esau about the deception, he said, "Yes, and he shall be blessed," because he realized that was the will of God and I was going against it. That's what Joseph is doing here. And that's unfortunately what many of us are doing when we take matters into our own hands. God made it very plain. "Look, vengeance is mine, I will repay." Don't take things into your own hands, be it government or any other thing. And people who have their eyes on God, they see that. When they don't, they don't. And so his father refused, and he said, "I know, my son, I know. You see, I'm not blind, I know what I'm doing. You don't." He said, "I know, my son, I know it. He also shall become a people, and he also shall be great. Howbeit, his brother, that is, a younger brother, shall be greater than he. And his seed shall become a multitude of nations." Said who? God. You see, that's the point. God is the one in charge of this whole ceremony, and you, Joseph, you do not see. You are the blind one, not me. And it's very interesting the way it happens oftentimes. When our eyes are not on God, we become blind. We don't see. And so he blessed them that day, saying, "By you," that is, "by you, Ephraim and Manasseh, shall Israel..." Who is Israel? You see, some people think in their ignorance that now Jacob said, "You, Ephraim and Manasseh, are Israel." Well, if they're Israel, who is this Israel Jacob is talking about here? He's saying that all the rest of the tribes of Israel are Israel. All of them are Israel. So he said, "By you shall Israel bless." all of Israel, Judah, you know, Reuben and Levi and Simeon and Naphtali and Dan and all that, they're all Israel. You're never taking, you know, the name Israel from them. That's what he's saying here. But you shall Israel bless, saying, God make you as Ephraim and Manasseh. And it's interesting, the only community to this very day, ironically, the only community that does it to this very day, literally, is the community of Judah. You see? And that's Israel. They're Israel. That's what Jacob is saying. When Judah makes, you know, this statement, and every time they do, and you see it, all the grandparents, that's generally they are the ones that pass on that, or, you know, when they come to visit their kids, you know, the grandchildren greet them at the door, and that's the first thing they do. You know, they put their hands on them, and they bless them, and that's the ceremony that you see to this very day. Well, anyway, we're going to stop here. This is again Mordecai Joseph saying greetings to all of God's people. Until next time.